Welcome back to Heartland Darkland. I'm Cassie.
And I'm Shannon.
Thank you for joining us yet again for episode 2, and thank you for all of the love and support for episode 1.
Seriously, that was crazy. I was so surprised and blown away by all the positive encouragement and support.
Yeah, no, everyone has been very kind with it, so thank you guys so much.
Yes.
I don't think we have as much to cover this time before the episode as we did last time, so we're gonna kind of just jump in tonight.
Let's do it.
So tonight, I'm the one telling the story, and I keep saying tonight, this is gonna air in the morning, but we're recording at night, so yeah. You guys get it. But the case I'm covering is the murders at the Glen Sheen Mansion in Duluth, Minnesota.
Okay.
So I had never heard of these. If you're from Minnesota, around there, you maybe have. It sounds like the family that was involved in this is pretty well known in the area. It was the Congdon family, and I apologize if I ever say any of these names wrong. But they were a very wealthy family in the area, but they were very giving to their community, and they did a lot of, like, charity work and stuff like that, so I'm pretty sure they were very well known in their community.
And when did you say this was? Sorry, you probably said that, or maybe you didn't?
I didn't yet. Okay. I have not said that yet.
You're jumping ahead, sorry.
Okay. You are. You're getting a little excited.
Okay.
It's fine. Okay. So, I'll kind of tell you first when it happened, and then we're going to go back to the beginning. So, it happened on June 27th of 1977.
Okay.
Elizabeth Congdon, who was 83, and her night nurse, Velma Petila, who was 66 at the time, were found murdered in the Glen Sheen Mansion.
Ooh.
So, that's the case.
Okay.
But we're going to kind of go back a little bit. So Elizabeth was one of 7 children to Chester and Clara Congdon. Now, Clara was a teacher from humble beginnings, and Chester was actually a lawyer, but he had a very humble background. His dad died when he was young. He kind of became the man of the family. While he was in school to become a lawyer, he actually sent money back to his family to help them. It took him a few years, but he became a successful lawyer, started a partnership, and then he started getting into, he invested in mines in the Minnesota area, and that's how he made his wealth. So he was a bit of a jack of all trades because he was also involved in, like, politics and things like that. I could go on forever about this family. So I am going to kind of let you guys know now, there is so much information I could give it that I am leaving out. This case alone could probably be its own podcast with, like, 8 to 10 episodes just to give you all the history on all the family.
Well, it's like a huge family, right? So, I mean, I would assume each member plays their part in this story?
To an extent. We're mostly just focusing on Elizabeth and her daughters.
Okay.
But I wanted to give a little bit of background about who Elizabeth was and who her parents were.
Yeah.
So because her parents did come from humble backgrounds, they very much were about their children giving back to their community. You know, they didn't spoil them. They raised them in a way to be grateful for what they have and to share with others. So they ended up buying this land in 1903 where they were going to build Glen Sheen Mansion on. So Glen Sheen Mansion sits on 14 acres near Lake Superior. So it's a lakefront property.
Okay. And I'm going to imagine that that wasn't a cheap...
Oh, we'll get to that. Yeah. Don't you worry.
I'm like, nowadays, I don't think that would be...
So we'll come to that.
Bucket.
We'll come to that. So the house had 39 rooms, and Chester spared no expense.
I just think about, cleaning all those rooms. But I guess when you have those rooms, you have a maid for that, probably.
Oh, yeah. They definitely had staff. So it had state-of-the-art technology for its time. They had hot water running through pipes under the sink in the butler's pantry to keep plates warm for second helpings.
Gosh.
A vacuum system throughout the house, buttons under tables so they could easily call for staff, and while the house originally had gas light fixtures, it was installed with wires for the eventuality of electricity.
Oh, dang.
So now we're getting to the money part. Lakefront houses at the time usually cost $11,000 to $16,000. Because remember, this is early 1900s. Yeah. Glensheen cost $864,000. Oh. And that was in 1904.
That's five. A lot of money now, let yes. alone.
So the book I got this from, I was reading a book. I want to say it was called The Will to Murder. I'll grab that later and check. But it said at the time, which this was 2009 currency, would have been $30 million in 2009. Gosh. So I can't even imagine what it would be at with 2022 inflation. I mean, I'm going to say that's got to be at least 50, 60 million by now. At least. I mean, I'm probably way off, but.
Nah, I feel like that's, I mean.
That's a lot of money.
Anything above a million, it's like you just lose me because it's all a lot of money.
It is. It is. So, like I said, despite all of their wealth, despite how much they spent on their house, Chester and Clara did not forget their humble roots. So they were involved with their community, with their church, and with different charities. And Elizabeth followed in her parents' footsteps. Everyone said she was very kind and very generous. She didn't want to be the center of attention, but just due to the nature of the fact that she was involved in so many charities and on so many boards, she kind of was. When Elizabeth was in her freshman year of college at Vassar, her father died on November 21st of 1960 of pleurisy. And according to WebMD, in case you don't know, that's a condition in which the pleura, which are membranes covering the lungs and chest wall, become inflamed. This causes pain when breathing because the two membranes rub against each other like sandpaper. So with his death, Elizabeth decided she should move back home to be with her mother. And then with that, she devoted herself to her mom and to volunteer and charity work. And some of the things she was involved in helping with were the Lighthouse for the Blind, which I'm assuming is some sort of institute.
Yeah.
Duluth Rehabilitation Center. And she even organized and headed the American Red Cross Nurses Aid Committee in Duluth during World War II.
Wow. Good people.
Yeah, she, by all accounts, she was a very kind person. So because of this, Elizabeth was not lacking in attention from suitors. And while she did come close to marrying a Fred Wolven, who was a childhood friend, she in the end told him she didn't love him enough to spend the rest of her life with him. And she never married anyone. No one's sure why.
Interesting.
She just never found the right person. Despite not being married, she still loved and wanted children. In 1939, at the age of 38, Elizabeth adopted a three-month-old baby who was named Jacqueline Barnes. She then renamed her Marjorie Mannering Congdon. 3 years later, she adopted a second baby girl who she named Jennifer Susan Congdon.
Good for her, you know?
Well, and so that's obviously very unheard of in the 1930s for a single woman to adopt. But you have to look at the fact that, one, she knows a lot of people in the right places, and she has money talks.
Yeah.
So she was obviously able to do that. Like, another single woman of lesser means would not have been able to.
I think even nowadays, that's like, I mean, it happens, and you see it and hear it, but it's not as common as it should be.
Or yeah.
Could be, I guess.
Probably not. Adoption in general, I know, is pretty expensive still to this day, so.
Well, good for her, you know?
Yeah. One person close to the family did mention that she knew Elizabeth loved her children, but she thought that Elizabeth maybe looked at them more like toys.
Ew.
And her mom actually did a lot of the caretaking of the girls.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't want to say I take back everything I said because I don't, but
yeah,
when you have money and you can do whatever you want with it, I guess that's a different story, too.
Yeah. So, the girls now were very different. Marjorie was shorter, dark-haired, and preferred books and being indoors, where her younger sister Jennifer was tall, with blonde hair, and shared a love of the outdoors like her mother did. Many of the staff and family said that Jennifer was a very well-behaved child who rarely disobeyed her mother and got along well with everyone. Like, she made friends with everyone, like, she was just that person that everyone loved. Marjorie, on the other hand, a little bit of a different story. If she was playing with others, she kind of insisted that she had to be in charge. It was done her way. She had to be the one doing all the things. She had to have all the toys. Like, and if she didn't get what she wanted, she would throw tantrums. So much so that sometimes she would even hit her mom in these tantrums. And Elizabeth would give in because to keep the peace, which probably not the best way to handle that.
You know, choose your battles, I suppose. Everyone,
you know,
handles it their own way, but we've all been there before.
So despite this, people say she could also be, Marjorie, that is, could be quite charming, and she could talk herself out of almost anything, which sounds like a big old red flag.
Yeah.
Someone who throws fits if they don't get their way, but can be super charming.
Yep. Yeah, I know a few of those.
Well, and I think all of us who've listened to and read enough true crime know that those are markers.
Red flag.
So as she went on, Elizabeth was always bailing Marjorie out of financial trouble. Marjorie loved horses. She manipulated her mom into buying two purebred horses for her. I think one was an Arabian.
Oh, gosh.
And there was some other, like, thoroughbred horse, which her mom was like, okay, cool, I'm going to buy this second one, but you already have the stallion, so now your sister gets this other one. So
it just makes me laugh because just a horse, you know, just buy me a horse.
Oh, horses come into play a lot with Marjorie. Elizabeth just kept bailing her out, and one of her brothers was like, you've got to give tough love, right? You can't keep doing this. It's not going to help anything. But Elizabeth didn't want the family name dirtied, if you will, sullied, yeah, because of Marjorie's financial issues. Like, she would constantly spend store credit in her mom's name, and I mean, so much stuff. I couldn't believe, I really
entitled
could not.
Much.
I could not believe how much she would just spend, and she was known for, like, lying. She was a compulsive liar. So eventually her mom was like, I'm gonna send you to Dana Hall, which is this exclusive all-girls boarding school outside of Boston. And Elizabeth herself had gone there. So she was hoping that there... She just figured Marjorie, this was an adolescence thing, which Marjorie was also very sensitive about the fact that she had been adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And so Elizabeth was hoping that by sending her to the school, they would kind of shape her up.
Yeah.
Reformed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Little foreshadowing, not so much. Mm-hmm. But
that was the hope. Okay, well.
That was definitely the hope. She still got into trouble there with her spending. She would still overspend even while she was there. She'd go to summer camps and that were like for horseback riding, and she'd spend all of this money to go to these stables to ride for the whole day, and then her mom would have to bail her out. But she'd send her mom these letters like, do not be talking to my teachers, like, you come to me. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what?
Wow. It has to get to a point when your child runs this show like that, you know? I mean, talk about enabling her, though. Like,
oh, she 100% enabled
and
her.
At that point, it's like hard to rein it back in. Like the horse pun there. But no, you know what I mean? Like, at that point, okay, it's so out of control that how are you ever going to get control back? You're not.
I mean, at that point, as a teenager, you could still potentially by cutting off. But I mean, no, you've done so much damage at that point already. So finally, after her junior year at Dana Hall, Elizabeth decided to take her to Menninger Clinic, which is a well-known psychiatric clinic in Topeka, Kansas, to be evaluated, because she figured at this point her daughter's compulsive lying, acting out at home, and money problems had to be more than just, oh, she's a teenager acting out.
Right. That's a little extreme.
And there she was diagnosed as a sociopath.
Okay. Tell us about that.
I do have...
Let's hear it. I mean, I have an idea, but for all those...
Right. I think that's one that, for myself, sociopath and psychopath and those things kind of get confusing for me sometimes. So I did go to psychology today. And
you're so prepared. I knew it.
I mean, I had to get the definition.
Right. Because those terms, I think, are thrown around nowadays so loosely that people just think that that's what, you know, someone acts one way or another and they just classify them as that.
Exactly. Exactly. So, sociopathy refers to a pattern of antisocial behaviors and attitudes, including manipulation, deceit, aggression, and a lack of empathy for others. Sociopathy is a non-diagnostic term, and it is not synonymous with psychopathy, though the overlap leads to frequent confusion. Sociopaths may or may not break the law, but by exploiting and manipulating others, they violate the trust that the human enterprise runs on. So that, again, is the definition from Psychology Today. So then after this diagnosis, she stays at the clinic for a few weeks, and then she's sent to a group home in St. Louis where she finished out her senior year at a special school. And the book just said a special school. I'm assuming it's something that's probably for like unruly teens and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or probably at this time frame, we're still in what, the 1950s or something. It was probably for like unwed mothers and things like that too.
Oh yeah.
So finishes school. Now, St. Louis is where she meets her first husband.
Okay.
She has a few of them in this. Richard Dick Leroy. So he was 24 at the time when she meets him, and she was 19. He's everything she's not. He's the exact opposite of her. He came from a humble beginning. He's a hard worker. He saw his mom be, you know, financially responsible. And Marjorie drew him in. You know, she's this outgoing, I mean, by all accounts, she could be very charming. And he was taken in by her. Their relationship started quick. And she told him about being at the clinic, but she played it off as an overbearing, overprotective mother. You know, it wasn't really anything to do with her. It was no big deal. And at this point, he's so enamored with her, he doesn't care. He mm-hmm. believes anything she's going to tell him. They were married on June 30th of 1951. I think they had only been together for less than a year at this point. In total, over the time they were together, they had 7 children.
Oh.
Yes. So they were still together for a while, but unfortunately, Dick finds out pretty quickly that she is not good with money, and she lies a lot. She told him she was going to school for nursing, but he never saw any proof of that. He was getting calls from creditors and stores saying she owed all of this money. She was buying horses. When she said she was at school, he was pretty sure she was riding all day on this horse she had. At one point, she bought every single one of her children a horse for Christmas. You know, they're going through all of this. He tried to make the marriage work for the sake of the children.
7 of them. I mean...
Yes. I mean, they even went to marriage counseling, and they both had individual counseling, which I'm like, for the back in the day, that's amazing that they had that.
Oh, yeah.
But Dick eventually realized, like, there was no saving this. And unfortunately, Marjorie kind of manipulated his children into believing that he was the bad guy. So they actually finally divorced in April of 1971. Now, over the course of this time after their divorce, some of Marjorie's children start to realize that their dad isn't at fault. I think a couple of them went to go live with them, but some of them stayed with their mom for a while because she was paying for things that they wanted to do. But she started to, like, even take money from her children and stuff. And, like, while Dick and her were married, when they would go back to visit Elizabeth, I read something about how, like, things would go missing. So she was stealing things from her mom's home and then pawning them for money because she was still spending way above their means. And so then she started doing these things to her kids. So eventually it comes down to it's just her and her youngest child, Rick. All the rest have gone either with their dad, or they're old enough to be on their own, or one of the other daughters moved in with one of her older brothers.
How sad.
Yeah. So then her and Rick eventually moved to Colorado. And this is where she meets Roger Caldwell. He was a divorcee as well, with a drinking problem. So they fell fast for each other and were married after just 2 months of dating in March of 1976. They continued to spend outside of their means, and everyone thought they were wealthy because of how they acted, the way they seemed to spend money. So this led to Judy McCoy and her husband befriending them because they owned and they were breeding and raising Arabian horses. And the Caldwells showed interest in purchasing the horses and breeding them themselves. So they're like, well, let's make friends with them. We'll see. And then it seemed like a good fit for a friendship. And then in December of 1976... when they were all vacationing together.
Oh no.
Marjorie asked Judy if she knew any syndicate people, which I'm assuming is like mafia kind of thing.
Okay. Never heard of that.
In the Denver area, because she wanted to put a hit out on her trust officer in Minneapolis. His name was Thomas Welch. So then Judy's like, oh, maybe I don't want to be friends with this person.
Yeah, red flag.
Yes, another red flag. So Now, she was given money in a trust, like, her mom had trust funds for uh-huh. her daughters, and they were given money accordingly, and so, of course, there were people in charge of that. That's a whole other long detail. Again, there was so much I could have gone into, but yeah. So she didn't like the way Thomas Welch was managing her money because he wouldn't give her money for every little thing she wanted. So we have that, and then we have Roger with his drinking problem, which it sounds like he was sober for some times, and then he'd just start drinking again.
Fall off the wagon.
Yeah. So he was, by all accounts, a mean drunk. Apparently there were lots of instances of them fighting and arguing in public after he had been drinking, and one instance was when they were leaving a party. Roger was intoxicated and insisted on driving. So him and Marjorie are in the car, and her son Rick was following behind. Well, he noticed Roger swerving all over the road. So he speeds up and blocks Roger so he can't continue. Mm-hmm. Well, Roger gets out and they argue. And Roger then beats Rick with a 12-inch tire chain.
Oh my gosh.
So Rick and his mom go running back to Rick's car. Eventually, Roger was arrested for assault and driving while intoxicated. But he agreed to go into, like, rehab.
Okay.
So Marjorie dropped the charges.
Okay.
And so then, over the course of all this time of them living in Colorado and stuff, too, they were also investigated because there were false burglary claims. They would say their house was broken into and things were missing. But then they'd find these things at pawn shops. There were burglaries around the town that were happening, and then they would see Marjorie with some of the items, or again in pawn shops.
Weird.
And they were also being investigated for fraudulent checks, because again, they're spending outside of their means. This is a time where it's easier to float checks.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, they would open accounts and write checks before the account was actually even fully opened.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so this is just nonstop.
And this is why checks are no longer really a thing. Because of people like that.
And so Elizabeth had even ended up co-signing a couple loans with Marjorie at this point for large sums of money that, of course, Marjorie defaulted on. And so now the rest of the family and, like, her nurses are trying to keep Marjorie from getting hold of her mom. Because at this point now, Elizabeth has had a stroke. She has a hard time talking. She can't walk very well. Like, one side of her body is paralyzed.
Because she's older. I mean, she's old at this point. Yeah, right? Her grandkids are pretty much all grown.
Yes. Okay. So at this point, she's older. At the time, like I said, at the time of the murder, she's 83.
Okay.
So at one point, Roger even, like, goes to Glen Sheen, like, a month before the murders to ask Elizabeth for a loan.
Okay.
First, he wants $750,000 so they can buy a ranch.
Okay.
And he said otherwise he would like at least $500,000 to get them out of debt so he's not arrested. But Elizabeth actually says no. She's good turned down. And at this point, I don't know if it was Elizabeth herself or if it was more like
a spokesperson for
the people who are in charge of the money at this point. But either way, he's turned away. So now this is what leads up to the murder of it all. On the morning of June 27th, 1977, Elizabeth, who was in her 80s, like I said, I'm pretty sure she was 83, and her night nurse, Velma Petila, were found murdered. Velma now had actually been one of Elizabeth's nurses for 7 years before she retired just the month prior. And she was actually always a day nurse. Uh-huh. She didn't work nights. She was 66 and had been a registered nurse since 1933. And she was only there that Sunday evening of June 26th to help cover for the regular night nurse. Velma hated working nights, and her husband strongly objected to her taking the shift. However, her affection for Elizabeth and sense of duty won out, and she agreed.
How sad. Ugh.
Yeah. Like, he begged her not to go. And she did, because she said she had missed Elizabeth. She's like, it was just going to be...
She's like a friend of hers at this point.
Right.
You know, when you care for someone that long.
And she told the head nurse, she's like, I'll do it this one time, but I'm not going to do it again. She doesn't like working nights, which I don't blame her.
No.
So she arrived to Glen Sheen at 11 p.m. to take over the nurse who had been working the shift before hers. And she would stay overnight until the head nurse, Mildred Garview, came in at 7 a.m.
Okay.
And again, a little bit more backstory on Velma. Her and her husband, Lauren, were childhood sweethearts, and they'd been married for 45 years with 3 grown children. They were still very much in love and were looking forward to having more time to travel and golf together with Velma's retirement.
Oh, God.
Because if it wasn't already sad enough.
I know.
I mean, all murder is sad.
Right. But, ugh.
So, the morning of the 27th, the maid, Hazel Conger, went to unlock the front door before Mildred arrived, so Mildred didn't have to ring the doorbell and disturb Elizabeth. However, she noticed the chain on the door was undone and the bolt was open. Now, in the shift change between the day nurse and the night nurse, they always go through the house to make sure all the windows and everything are locked, and the night nurse locks up the front door after the other nurse leaves. Uh-huh. Hazel's like, okay, I guess, you know, Velma hasn't done this for a little bit, and she wasn't the night nurse, so she just assumed they'd forgotten it. So then as Mildred arrived and headed upstairs to meet with Velma to discuss how the night went, she noticed legs dangling on the landing between the first and second floors. As she approached, she found Velma laying awkwardly on a seat below the window on the landing. Now, at first, Mildred thought maybe she'd just fallen and was kind of sitting there trying to, like, get up or rest for a moment. Or maybe she'd even fallen asleep there. But as she got closer, she realized there was a pool of blood beneath her head.
Oh.
So Mildred checked her for signs of life, and finding none, she inspected her body. She noticed her jaw appeared to be broken, and her face was covered in blood. Her uniform was splattered in it, and there was another pool of it below the chair. Then, several feet from the body was a blood-covered candlestick.
Later
autopsies would say that she was beaten so badly, her, like, features weren't even recognizable. And they noticed nylon tied around her wrist, and it was tied so tightly they had to cut it off. So they don't know if originally he was going to try to, the murderer was going to try to tie her up, and there was a struggle, and then they fought, or what exactly was going on with that.
Brutal. And this is going to sound very weird, but when you said candlestick, the first thing I thought of was Clue.
I'm not going to lie, when I was reading that and writing that,
Because it's like, okay, I remember, you know, when playing that game, I always thought, how do you kill someone with a candlestick unless you just hit them, you know, over and over, so...
Well, and you have to realize, too, there's a picture of this candlestick in the book. Like, this is, like, a candlestick that's probably from the 1900s. These are solid, heavy things.
Yeah.
And they're a little bigger than, I think, what we think of nowadays.
Right. I know. Because you think it's something very minimal, and it's...
No, it's not. It's has substance. So now Mildred, realizing Velma's dead, is concerned for Elizabeth. So she goes rushing into her room, and that's where she sees the room is kind of torn apart, the dresser drawers are pulled open, and jewelry boxes are dumped and empty. When she approaches Elizabeth, she's lying face up, but her sheets have been pulled back, and her arm is bruised and exposed, and that arm is a ring that's missing. There's a missing ring and a missing watch. And this ring, I think this is the ring that Marjorie was very attached to. She very much wanted it. I guess Elizabeth at one point said to one of Marjorie's daughters, one day this will be yours, and Marjorie was like, no, it'll be mine. It was like a diamond and sapphire ring. Everyone knew, like, Elizabeth always wore it. Mm-hmm. So that's gone as well. There was also this gold coin missing. Byzantine era? I totally butchered that saying. Sorry, guys. But that was missing as well. That's gonna come into play later. So then, one of the things, though, that the police noticed when they're looking in Elizabeth's room was that it appeared to be staged. The drawers were all open the exact same distance. They were all, like, 6 inches, which one isn't enough to go through all of them, and how are you gonna have them all open the same?
Right. Especially if the motive really was just to rob the place. You know, like, that's...
Right. And then, on top of that, the drawers, you know, it didn't look like they'd actually been gone through. And the empty jewelry boxes looked like they'd been placed on the floor. Oh, and I probably should have mentioned. So, Elizabeth had been suffocated.
Okay.
She was smothered. Her pillow...
Well, and if she can't... Is she strong enough to fight that off anyway?
No, it appeared that she did try to fight. They said that due to an abrasion on her nose, it looked like she was trying to move her head back and forth with the satin pillow. And her bruised arm was probably from her trying to fight off her attacker.
How sad. So did the nurse, Velma,
right? Yeah.
Was it blunt force trauma then with her?
I mean, at that point,
you would just assume, I guess, if she was beat.
Yeah.
How awful.
So, aside from Elizabeth's room being gone through, Velma's purse had been rifled through, and her car keys, and then subsequently her car, were gone. Which will later be found at an airport a few hours away.
Huh.
The medical examiner actually believed Velma had been killed sometime after midnight, and the night nurses keep a log of what they're doing over the night, like the medications they give her, because several times throughout the night between 11 p.m. and 2:30 a.m., Elizabeth has to be moved and given medications.
Okay.
The only entry in this was Velma checking in, like signing in, saying, hey, I got here at 11 p.m. So they think she had to have been killed before she could do anything else.
So it was a pretty early thing.
Yeah.
It's like they were almost waiting. They knew when they...
It could be, yeah. So they estimate the time of death is then sometime between 11 p.m. and 2:30 a.m. And then, again, over the course of the investigation now, many people pointed out that Marjorie had a strained relationship with her mom, that her inability to be financially responsible and her mom bailing her out all the time, you know, caused friction between them. And the fact that Elizabeth had denied them money these last couple of times, they had a very strained relationship. But then it also came out that Marjorie on several occasions tried to encourage her diabetic mother to eat candy and sweets, even though she was medically not allowed to. And then there was another suspicious incident at one point where there was a time when Marjorie came over for a visit with homemade bread and what she said was sugar-free marmalade. However, a few hours after Elizabeth ate this, she became very ill. Like, she was lethargic and sleeping for 2 days, just very sick. So her doctor ran blood tests and found traces of meprobate.
Something like that.
Yep.
Okay.
Which is a powerful sedative. That was not one of her medications. But unfortunately, tests couldn't prove how, when, or who would have given Elizabeth these sedatives.
How sad. Gosh. That's crazy.
So, over the course of looking, police find a broken window in the billiard room, which is...
Another clue thing. I know. Sorry, I can't. The candlestick. I mean, it's not funny, but, no. You know. It's ironic.
I know what you mean. So, this is where the killer must have come in. And they also noticed blood residue in the sink in the bathroom of the room that Velma had been staying in, but there were no fingerprints. So they think he went in there, washed his hands, stole her car, took off. So everyone in the family is pretty much urging police to look at Roger and Marjorie. Like I said, a month prior, he had been out there asking for money and was denied.
Well, and it sounds like all the items that were taken were ones that someone was aware of where they would be found, and
we're also coming back to more of that.
Okay.
So these are kind of the things that lead them to it. So one of the items found was that coin. Well, an envelope addressed to Roger was sent from Duluth and postmarked on the day of the murders, and it had this coin in it.
Oh.
And an expert claimed that a thumbprint that was found on it was Roger's, and they also suspected that the handwriting on it was Roger's. They also found a bunch of jewelry in their hotel room in Marjorie and Roger's, because they're now back for the funeral. So police search their hotel room and they find this jewelry, and Marjorie's like, no, that's mine. My mom and I have a lot of similar jewelry. But everyone knows she's pawning her jewelry.
Right. So it's not like they've been real careful about that.
Exactly. So, despite there not being any, like, actual, like, heavy concrete evidence, it's all a lot of circumstantial evidence, they arrest Roger 2 weeks after the murders. Now, the defense, I'm not going to go super in-depth because, like I said, there's so much with Roger's case that comes out, so much with, like, before leading up to how they find him, you know, they arrest him and stuff. I mean, so much information.
It's just like scratching the surface.
Yeah, so I'm keeping the court stuff kind of very bare minimum here.
Uh-huh.
So, despite the defense, they have arguments that the police messed up. So, there was a witness who had stated they saw a young man in his 20s with shoulder-length blonde hair walking by the Congdon estate at 2:30 a.m. The police never searched for this person to question them at all, because they figured it was a hot summer day.
Right.
Young teens are doing this all the time.
Yeah.
So, okay. And then they did take a bunch of pictures of the crime scene and evidence, but they didn't log it. They didn't know when it was taken, where it was taken, any of this stuff. So the defense was like, they could have taken this at any time and staged it. Right. We don't know.
Right. I mean, that's easy, I guess, if you can just even give that little bit of the doubt, you know, to the jury. That's all it takes.
So you would think, I feel like nowadays that would be enough at least for like a mistrial.
Oh, absolutely. That's like almost not even enough to go to trial. I mean,
it's hard to say, but anyways.
This was, what, the 70s, once again? It's older. I mean,
I think there was a couple of years before his actual, like, trial day. It was, like, a year into his... Yeah, it was still fairly soon. The trial happened pretty quickly because he was sentenced on July 11th of 1978. So,
oh, wow.
About a year later. Oh, so, yeah, so he was still found guilty despite these issues, and he was given two life sentences, one for each woman. Okay. So the morning after Roger's sentencing on July 11th, 1978... Marjorie was arrested and charged with murder and conspiracy in Duluth. So her lawyer got the police complaint against her sealed. So that means the public couldn't have access to it. So the press was not okay with this. They were like, that's not okay at all. Like, we have a right to know these things. So they actually hired an attorney. And so attorneys representing several different news outlets claimed that stealing these records violated the First Amendment and the public's right to know. Now, Marjorie's lawyer said, you know, it would threaten her right to a fair trial if this was all made public.
Money talks, I guess.
Well, the judge did rule for the media, but he kept the file sealed until after Marjorie's lawyer could appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. 1 week later, the Supreme Court also agreed in favor of the media, and the files were made public. So on August 17th, 1978, Marjorie was then indicted on two counts of first-degree murder and two counts of conspiracy to commit murder, which she pled not guilty to. So during her trial, though, Marjorie, this is where that manipulation comes into play. She would sit there and knit, have like a book on the table, smile super kind. You know, she'd be the kind lady knitting.
A little old lady. I mean, smiling, old at this point, you know.
Smiling to the jury. She even went so far as to bring a cake for her lawyer on his birthday.
Oh yeah, people love that. Mm-hmm. They eat that right up.
So then you have her playing the kindly person. How could she possibly have had anything to do with her mother's murder? And then her lawyer hired an expert who said that fingerprint on the envelope wasn't Roger's. And then a waitress who had been interviewed in Colorado 2 years prior and said she never saw Roger at this diner now came to Minnesota, testified that she saw Roger there.
Like an alibi is what she said?
Yeah, okay. It was essentially an alibi.
Okay.
Because some people, one thing that I didn't really talk about is that like some of the people who knew Roger said they saw him the day the murders had been discovered, but he was super tired. And one of the things was that this car being found at the airport, it had a parking ticket for like 6:35 in the morning. And so they said that was enough time if he had killed them
to drive it there.
To drive it there and fly back to Colorado.
Yeah.
And like people said that when they saw him later that morning, like he was so tired he could barely keep his eyes open. So, you know, they had interviewed people there, and this one waitress was like, no, I never saw him. So now she's saying she did. So after a 6-week trial and 10 hours of deliberation, the jury found her not guilty.
Wow.
Some even, like, hugged her, stayed friendly with her, would go to lunch with her after the trial and stuff.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
Yes. So now, because Marjorie was found not guilty, and the expert in her trial said that wasn't Roger's fingerprint, Roger's lawyers file an appeal.
Yeah.
Now, the waitress did eventually recant and went back to saying she never saw Roger. But at this point, it's too late for Marjorie's case.
Right. That's already been tried.
Yeah. And his lawyers have already put forth, and I think it had already been, the Supreme Court had already overturned his conviction and ordered a new trial. So
that's... Well, and that's not even a solid alibi. I mean, without proof, like, anyone can say, oh, yeah, I saw them. So that's an interesting concept. What made her decide, you know what I mean? It makes you wonder what money, I guess, once again. But
could be. So now, Roger's already served more than 5 years in prison. So while he's awaiting this being tried again, he's released. And I think he moved back to his hometown that was in Pennsylvania. while waiting. So Duluth authorities at this point are now concerned that a new trial so many years later, and then with Marjorie's expert, like, it's going to be too difficult to get a guilty verdict. So they don't want to, but they figured a plea deal's their best option. So at first they come to Roger and like, listen, if you plead guilty, we'll only make you serve one more year. And he was like, no, thank you. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you guys can do better than that. So then
one year, dude? Come on.
Well, he wins out.
Yeah. So he was right. Okay.
Yeah. Because then they're like, okay, fine.
If they don't have enough on him probably anyway, so that's
so they were like, fine, if you plead guilty, you don't have to serve any more time. We just want you to plead guilty.
Just so they can mark it off, say this was done, justice was served, huh?
Pretty much. So he says sure. So in court, he claimed that he broke in only to steal, but he had been drinking heavily, so he doesn't really remember anything. That's his whole thing, and he doesn't really show any sort of remorse or anything like that, but he's a free man. He's good to go. And now, at this point, him and Marjorie are still married, but they're not together.
Okay.
And we'll get back into that still. But they are still technically together. Or married, I mean. So he then at one point tries to extort money from the remaining Congdon family, saying, if you pay me $50,000, I will give you evidence of other people being involved.
Oh my gosh, sick.
So they agree to it at first, but like, you have to give us solid evidence. Mm-hmm. Well, he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. And I want you to pay me $100,000 instead. So obviously they were like, get fucked.
Yeah.
And that was all that they needed to do with that. So then, in 1988, Roger ends up taking his own life. And they find a note beside him saying he didn't commit the murders, like, he would never harm anyone. Except his girlfriend at the time was in the hospital for a broken collarbone because he had beaten her. So, take that with a grain of salt.
Interesting.
And now, that's Roger, you know? Did he do it? Did he not?
And he's the one, the same one, that got...
That beat
yes, the Marjorie's car situation. Yes. Okay. Sorry, I was just going back to that thinking, well, he already has a history of violence.
Yes.
And the thing, too, if he beat the nurse, you would think the blood spatter would be, like, on him at some point. And did he really, like, how would no one have seen, like, if he is wearing those same clothes... Where would he have disposed of those? I mean, it's just a very sketchy, like...
There's a lot. Like I said, there's so much that I've left out. And, like, so much, like, the book.
I want to dive into that. I'm going to go down a rabbit hole later.
I mean, I can let you borrow the book. And I can link to the Amazon link of where I bought the book in our show notes. It's very, very detailed.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to think they got away with it. I mean...
We're not even done. Oh, yeah, we're not even done, are we?
Oh, no, God. Sorry. I'm like at the end thinking that we're.
Oh, you think?
That's a crazy story, and it's not even done. Okay.
It's not even fully done because there's a couple other suspicious deaths.
Oh, gosh. Here we go.
So now let's backtrack a little bit to a few months after Roger's guilty conviction. Marjorie starts a relationship with a man named Wally Hagen, who she's actually known since her first marriage to Dick.
Okay.
Because she was good friends with his wife, Helen. They had kids around the same age. They were all doing the same thing. So they were really good friends. So they start up a relationship. But there's one little hitch. Helen's still very much in the picture. Very much married to Wally.
Okay. So we're mistress at this point.
And she's still friends with Helen now. Like,
wow. And Helen doesn't know.
No.
Okay.
Nope. So about a year later then, when it's like 1979, I want to say, Helen... is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, which apparently then they just called being senile.
That's sad.
Yeah. We're still going to call it Alzheimer's because that's what it was.
Yeah.
So Helen would then often tell her children incidents involving Marjorie, like that she stole her wedding rings.
Huh.
And that their father was having an affair with her. Now, the wedding ring incident, her one daughter, Nancy, who was very much involved during this time, asked her dad about it, and her dad's like, no, she made that up.
Of course, it's easy to say that in this situation because of that.
Yeah. Which...
That sucks.
My grandma had dementia, and she would slip in and out of stuff. And so, like, it is... I can understand where her daughter would think...
As okay, a daughter, yeah.
Think, okay, it's just the disease.
Well, and you want to think that your dad's not, you know, doing that. Well, and
someone
that
you've known as a child wouldn't take advantage of to your mom like that.
Yeah, that's awful.
So, in 1980, Helen was hospitalized due to complications with her Alzheimer's and her diabetes. She was having a hard time swallowing, taking fluids, stuff like that. So after several weeks being in the hospital, she was placed in Twin Birch Nursing Home. That was on Sunday, March 23rd of 1980. At this point, she's in excellent physical condition. Like, she has Alzheimer's and there's complications mm-hmm. with that, but, like, her physical health is fantastic. So then, on Thursday, March 27th, Helen's daughter Nancy gets a call saying, "Your mom slipped into a coma." Now, she had just seen her the other night. She was perfectly fine. Everything was okay. She doesn't understand. She calls her mom's doctor, and he can't understand it either. There's absolutely no reason why she should have slipped into a coma.
Right. I don't know enough about Alzheimer's to know if that's like a...
Oh, we're getting down more.
Okay, I was going to say, because that seems pretty out there.
So, while Nancy's there, she's looking at her mom's chart, and she sees on it where it says to contact her daughter, Nancy's name's written, it's like scratched out, and Marjorie's name is written in.
Oh no, she didn't. Oh.
So Nancy's like, "This is not her daughter. I'm her daughter. I should be contacted." And this nurse was like, "Oh, she was here the other night. She was feeding your mom out of baby food jars and stuff like that." Now, at this point, Nancy's like, "Oh, she's just being a kind, caring friend.
Suspect anything.
Doesn't think anything of it." Also, because she doesn't know about the whole marmalade incident. So she has nothing. She's like, "Okay, well, that's weird." So unfortunately, her mom does pass then on that Sunday, March 30th of 1980, which happened to be Palm Sunday. And her doctor couldn't figure out why. He said she should have lived another 12 to 15 years. She was only in her 60s.
Oh, wow. That is young. Yeah.
Yeah. So after her death, Wally's now very open about his relationship with Marjorie. So Nancy now realizes her mom was telling the truth, at least about that. He even went so far as to confront Nancy and yell at her, telling her he hated Helen for the 43 years they were together. Now, this is after Helen's will had been read, and it was revealed that she left all of her real estate, which was a house and three lots, to her children. She did stipulate that Wally could live in the house until his death, but then it would go to Nancy. So, along with this, their kids started to notice that not only was he becoming more and more involved with Marjorie, like, very open with his relationship out in public. He didn't care that his wife had just died, but he was also changing. He had mood swings, and with these were like horrible fits of anger out of nowhere for no reason. Like nothing had happened. He would just out of nowhere get angry. And then they learned that Marjorie was pressuring him to liquidate all of Helen's real estate. And mind you, he doesn't have any of that. That's his children's.
He can't do that, right?
Okay. Right. Well, so Nancy then hears from a friend of her mother's that Wally came to her and wanted her to say under oath that Helen was not in her right state of mind. He put that she was quote unquote crazy at the time she wrote the will. Now her friend was like, "I'm not going to say that. She was never."
Right.
She was always perfectly fine and capable and in her right state of being.
They wouldn't have like signed off of that. Like if that was the case. Right? I mean, for a will.
Right. No. So then he tries.
These people are crazy. Okay. I can't. Sorry, this is just a lot.
So then Wally goes to his son, Tom, and he asks him to sign over his right to inheritance. So this way Wally can be the one to distribute it all. Now, Tom is like, "Okay, maybe this is right. I don't want to screw over my dad, but let me talk to my lawyer." And his lawyer is like, "No, no, no.
Hard pass.
We're not doing that." So Tom tells his dad, he's like, "No, I know what you're trying to do. I'm not signing this over to you." So Wally then is like, "You're dead to me. I don't have a son. Don't ever contact me." Well, Rick, who, remember, is Marjorie's youngest son,
yep,
then goes to Wally's other son, Dick, with a release form. He brings it to him. He's like, "Here, here's a release form for you to sign over your inheritance to your father." And Dick was like, "No, not doing that." So again, Wally's like, "I don't have a son. You're dead to me. Don't ever contact me." So in a rage, he moves out of the house and he moves in with Marjorie.
Bye. See you never.
But Nancy kind of starts to notice, like, one, like, she'll come home to this house and, like, lights are on, doors unlocked. She starts getting calls in the middle of the night, said, "We're out to get you." And somehow her brothers don't believe her at first, and I don't understand that if you see how your dad's been. But they do finally believe her when one night Nancy comes back home at around 11 p.m. to find that her house has been broken into. Now, her house is ransacked, but of the missing items are her mother's will, and these receipts she had kept, because, see, Nancy had been paying for a lot of the stuff for her mom's medical expenses, and she even mortgaged her house.
Wow.
So she was saving these receipts, hoping to get paid back. This totaled around $50,000. She later learns, so these receipts now are missing.
Mm-hmm.
She later learns that that $50,000 that she had given her dad, he didn't spend on her mom. He spent on him and Marjorie. Because Marjorie had convinced him that he was not responsible for taking care of Helen in any way. So, I don't know.
Grown-ass man.
Yeah, so I don't know if Nancy ever gets her money back and stuff. Like, I hope for her sake. So then, on August 7th of 1981, despite still being legally married to Roger, Marjorie marries Wally. And she applies for the marriage license in North Dakota, where her name's not well known. Now, authorities did file bigamy charges against her, but it wasn't something they could extradite her for, so they were just still free. So they did it, I guess, maybe on the off chance that she ever came back to town. I don't know.
Interesting.
But then, shortly after that, they sold their house, which they had in Twin City. And the night they moved out, this house caught on fire.
That's ironic.
Yeah. So, apparently Marjorie had some other incidences of, like, arson in her background as a child and stuff like that. So, she actually still owed on the mortgage. And they did eventually charge her with insurance fraud and arson.
Good. And
she spent 20 months in prison for this. So, after her release, her and Wally then moved to Ajo, Arizona? A-J-O?
That's what I would say.
Ajo.
Ajo. Sorry, all of our Arizona friends.
Anyways, this small town in Arizona is near the Mexican border, and they live there in an RV. So at this point, Marjorie's telling people, it said they moved there in an RV, but then at another point, it sounds like they're in a house. So I'm a little confused on that, but they're there.
Okay.
And at this point, Marjorie's telling everyone that Wally has cancer. And they have to go to Mexico to get his medication. And Wally is in, like, a wheelchair. He's not...
He's playing the part? Or...
I don't think he's playing.
Okay. Okay, well, with her, you never know.
Well, again, you keep getting ahead of me.
I know. Okay.
So, shortly after they move there, a bunch of small fires start to... In, like, garages and I think some empty houses and stuff. And the police just think it's teenagers. Until... Marjorie and Wally get into a fight with their neighbor. It's their next door neighbor. They, like, said that he threw trash in their yard. And I don't...
Petty. Yeah.
Yeah. So this man also is, like, a border patrol officer. I'm like, why would you start something with that? But okay.
Right.
So their neighbor then finds a kerosene-soaked rag on his windowsill. And he called the police. So the police are like, okay, let's, like... It's a sting operation. We're going to see if someone comes back later.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why you would pre-plant that.
Right.
But, all right. Sure enough, it works. Because later around 1 a.m., they see a flash. They chase down the person. Guess who it is?
Oh my gosh. I'm going to take a wild guess and say it's Marjorie.
How did you know?
Oh, man. Unless Wally just jumped up out of that wheelchair, I guess. And went for a run, but...
Yeah. So at this point...
What is she trying... You said these small fires. What was the purpose of that? Were they burning something specific or?
Not that I could see. Maybe it's just
the thrill of it?
It might be.
Okay. It's weird.
I mean, some people just starting fires.
I mean, that's fair. Yeah. Okay.
So she's arrested and she was jailed for 8 months because she couldn't afford bail. Now, during this time, Wally starts to make it a he's on the up and up. He's out of his wheelchair, he's driving around town, he's going to restaurants, flirting, all the things.
Wow. Except Wally.
Then weirdly, when he goes to testify at Marjorie's trial, he's wheeled in on a gurney.
That's extreme.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So he tells the jury that Marjorie's arthritis is so bad she couldn't even light a match. However, jurors then see him walking to his car and driving himself away from the courthouse. So I think they don't really believe his testimony.
Uh-huh. And people have seen him around town, I'm sure, at this point also, right?
Right. And I don't know if her trial was somewhere further away because it's a small town.
But I mean, there should be plenty of people they could have had testify that said, hey, he was just out for a run. I mean, that's maybe a bit extreme, but
yeah,
they could testify against that.
So jurors this time around aren't buying into her stuff, and good. She's found guilty. She then later pleaded no contest to the other small arsons, and she was sentenced to 15 years in prison.
Wow.
Now, okay. She requested from the judge to have just one day out so she could take care of Wally, which I'm not sure why, since clearly he's fine at this point, but the judge is like, yeah, sure, why not?
Oh, gosh.
He does at least think she's a flight risk, so he makes cops, like, watch her.
Oh, good, good.
Well,
something's gonna happen with this, I can see already.
Yeah. So the next day, a police officer smelled natural gas coming from her house. Which also, I want to know, one, how close do you have to be to smell natural gas? Or how much natural gas is coming out of this house that you smell this?
Yeah, good point.
Either way leads to more questions for me, because then he knocks on the door and she's like, oh, the pilot light on my stove went out, we're all good. And he just was like, okay, cool. Walks away. I feel like if you smell enough natural gas and this woman is charged with arson, you maybe...
Right. That's probably another red flag.
Maybe we're like, we're just going to take a look around.
I wouldn't even be walking up there at that point. Like, how do you know she's not going to light something then and there and boom?
So, unfortunately, a few hours later, Marjorie calls a friend and says that Wally's dead. So when the police come in, they find that the gas hose had been cut. It was just long enough to reach from the kitchen to the bedroom. And along with that being in the bedroom, there's a bunch of pills and a couple suicide notes. Apparently it was going to be a double suicide. Marjorie couldn't handle being in prison. And because of his health, Wally literally could not live without her. So she's then charged with murder. Oh, they also put they wanted to be buried together.
Quite the love story there. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So at first she's charged with murder, but the autopsy on Wally does reveal that he had overdosed, and there's no way to prove that he didn't take it himself.
Yeah.
So then they're worried that it would be hard to prove that she had murdered him, that they couldn't prosecute her, because then what's to say that she didn't just chicken out after he did it?
That's true.
So murder charges are dropped. She's just serving for arson. And she served, I think, around 10 of the 15 years.
Okay.
So
at this point, how old is she? Do we know? I mean,
listen, I could have mathed. I didn't.
I know. No, I mean, are we talking like 60s? Are we talking 70s? Or maybe
let's
no.
See, it's well, in the 80s.
Her friend was in her 60s.
Yeah,
when she died.
So we're around 70
okay,
something.
Okay. Okay.
This point, by the time she gets out of jail, she's probably like what 80? Eh.
She's close to it. Still going strong.
Mid to late 70s. Okay. Listen. There was so much information, and I didn't think about details of her age.
I don't do the whole math thing, so that's fine. That was
someone out there who's listening, if they want to, with the dates I've at least given, and can probably figure out her age.
Just a ballpark would be great.
And listen, we're going to say around mid-70s, okay,
yeah, I think
this
that's
point?
Good. That's good. That gives me an idea of how well she's getting around, you know?
Okay, well, she's still got more to do, so.
Oh, my gosh. Well, she's lived a life, I guess. I don't know about good, but...
So then in 2007, she befriends a man named Roger Samus, who was in an assisted living home, and she offered to help him with his finances because she clearly is an expert on how to...
Con artist.
So then Roger here soon dies, but she kept writing checks to herself.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, she did.
Mm-hmm. So she was caught for that.
Okay.
And then police wanted to determine his cause of death, but Marjorie had been... She had power of attorney and had already had him cremated.
Oh, of course.
Another red flag a-waving. So they couldn't charge her, obviously, with anything for that. But so she was charged with fraud and forgery. And for this, she was only sentenced. So her trial and sentencing takes a while because of her health and stuff at this point. So finally, in 2009, she is then sentenced to 3 years of intensive probation, which I'm not sure what intensive probation means. I didn't look it up at this point. I'm sorry.
I feel like at that age, yeah, there's not, I mean,
what is she? She's
better.
She's probably about 80.
Than others, but
yeah.
Yeah. Like she's going to.
Well, and she'd had health issues.
And all that. And I smoke that she's been around in her time.
I probably should have looked up at this point. I did kind of try to see. I didn't look to see if or when she had died. She might still be alive. I did see. Elizabeth's other daughter, Jennifer, passed away, I think it was like 2017 or 18.
Okay.
So by all accounts, she was a lovely woman.
Yeah.
exact opposite of.
Right. I was actually thinking earlier what happened to her, because we never really heard. I mean, she must have just stayed out of the.
Yeah.
Limelight.
I'm the one book that I read, like, they kind of talked to her, like, she had said a few things about her sister and stuff in it. But, I mean, she was the good child.
Yeah. Gosh.
So that's Marjorie. All right. That's, you know. After that, like, I know at one point she tried to get her probation revoked so she can move, and the judge was like, no. And she was like 83 at the time.
Lady, and that was like, going?
To that. No. So at this point, I mean, I'd find it hard to believe that she's still alive.
Yeah. I'm gonna have to, I'm curious, like, what?
I don't know. I didn't Google.
I mean, it doesn't even deserve that much at this so, point. It seems like she was not a good person.
No. So that's the Glensheen murder or mansion murders, but there's still a little bit more to this. Oh. So, of course, now then, too, so, like, how I actually found this was because I was trying to look for hauntings in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
Why Minnesota? I don't know. I just
it's
thought it sounded
heartland,
like...
It.
Yeah,
right?
Well, no, yeah. I was like...
And it's fine.
I was like, Minnesota's the next place I want to go. So, that's how I found it, because some people think the Glensheen Mansion, which is now owned by the university, like,
oh.
Chester said, after my last living child passes, then this will go to them.
Interesting. Can you go visit it?
Yes. You can take tours and stuff.
Should we go on a little field trip?
I mean, Minnesota's
That's
actually...
pretty interesting.
I went to Detroit Lakes, Minnesota a few years ago with my mother-in-law, and it was beautiful.
Yeah. I went to a wedding. My cousin... I don't know.
But
yeah, if they're listening, where did you guys get married? Because it was somewhere in Minnesota, and it was really beautiful.
Yeah, it was
yeah.
beautiful. I don't think I'd want to go in the wintertime.
No. No, no.
But,
too cold.
So some people say it's haunted... People who, like,
yeah.
staff who work there say, no, it's not. But some people say they've seen shadowy figures. They feel cold spots where Velma's found. I mean, who knows?
I'd
be interesting.
It's eerie. And, I mean, you would never want to live there after something like that. You know what I mean? So, that's interesting.
I mean, a part of it, though, too, like, I very much believe in the paranormal. But I think, too, like, how much of this is people who know the story and, like...
Yeah.
It's their
if you
own.
Didn't know anything about it and you went in there,
yeah.
would you sense that or not?
I'd be
is
curious.
Is it in your head?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be curious about that. So now there is one other weird thing that ties into this whole case. Another murder actually took place here. But
in the mansion?
Not in the mansion, but on the property.
Okay.
97 years to the day that Elizabeth and Velma were found. So
that's
other
crazy.
Yeah. So this other murder, which I'm going to talk very briefly on, took place on June 27th, 1880.
Okay.
Yep. So it was before.
I mean, I guess, yeah. Because I'm like, wait, yeah. okay.
So,
that wouldn't have worked out.
No. So at this point, it's just land, right? But apparently, I was kind of reading this article about it. Apparently, they would have like, why can't I think of it? The beer pit, not pits, like a little outdoor beer party thing there.
Beer garden?
That's the word
yeah.
I am
oh,
looking
there,
for.
Look at that. Yeah, yeah.
Don't know
yeah,
why I
mean,
blinked on that.
When I think of beer
so
garden,
hard.
I think of like small town trashy, like, you know, so it's, I mean,
yeah.
it's just funny.
But
back in the 18, I mean, they probably liked to party
so
then too.
I guess there was like a brewer who lived around there and like, I don't know, someone got a permit so they could do this. Okay.
Okay.
And so a man named Herman Opel struck another man named Edward Brennan, who was trying to break up a fight between his brother and a completely different man. So Herman had nothing to do with this fight, but he was drunk and he wanted to keep watching it.
Okay.
Early UFC, I guess.
Yeah. That's how it all begins.
So Herman hit Edward with a loaded cane. What's a loaded cane, you ask? I will tell you.
Uh-huh. I would love to. I have my ideas, but...
It's a cane that's hollowed out and filled with molten lead.
Oh, I was going to say for drugs, but lead too.
So he hits Edward. Edward falls and was dead 3 minutes later.
Wow.
So ultimately, 2 years after the death, Herman was found not guilty because Edward had no broken bones and there was no bleeding. There was just a bruise. Because clearly in the 1800s, they
right.
don't understand how serious head wounds are.
No.
So they say that couldn't have killed him.
Yeah, and it's not like they are, like, you know, doing autopsy and seeing, looking for internal bleeding. And
right.
If there's nothing on the outside, they're just going to chalk
right.
it up to, yeah, something simple.
Something weird happened.
Yeah.
Yep. it wasn't because of Herman. Who knows? It was a weird coincidence, apparently.
That is super bizarre.
So that is the Glen Sheen Mansion murders. And again, I'm so sorry if I was butchering the name of the mansion or any other names in this.
That it was a really cool case. And I like how it tied in with, I know it wasn't as much of a, you know, quote, haunting, but knowing that you can still go visit there and then you always hear these stories about things. And I think that there can totally be a presence there, especially if it's like an unresolved thing, you know, kind of. I mean, in Marjorie, that's such a crazy,
I mean,
crazy story with her and everything.
To me, there's no doubt she murdered Helen.
Yeah.
She murdered Wally. She murdered Roger Samus.
Is that the last one?
That's the last one.
I was like, I know, the names I can't remember. She obviously had something to do with her mother's death.
Yeah.
And Velma.
Yeah.
Poor Velma. That makes me sad for her. I mean, that makes me sad for everyone.
But
very much innocent.
The fact that she had literally just retired a month prior, she wouldn't have been there. It's just interesting. I do know that her family tried to sue the Congdon estate for wrongful death, saying they were at fault. And at first they won some money, but then it got overturned, which her husband actually passed away right before he found out that got overturned. So I don't know. I guess my thought is I didn't see anything. I guess I kind of would have hoped that maybe the Congdon family, having had more money, at least would have paid for some of like the funeral expenses and stuff.
Yeah, especially because she was there caring for
her,
you know, and she probably was loved by the family if she worked for them that long.
Right. So I don't know if there was money, if they had given them money still and the other family was still trying to sue for wrongful death because they thought there should have been more security there and stuff like that. But again, it was definitely, I left so many details out. I can't even tell you.
Yeah, like, whatever, did they ever find any of the stuff that was taken from the murder scene? I mean, the crime scene that, you know?
I think they did. I think the stuff that they found in Marjorie and Roger's room, that stuff, I think they confiscated.
So that at least would tie them to the scene. Okay.
Yeah. I think Marjorie did still, I don't think she got her full inheritance because her children then, like, tried to sue, even though she was found not guilty, tried to make it so she couldn't get her inheritance. I think she still got partial inheritance, but clearly she blew all of that right away too.
Right.
This woman did not know how to spend. Like, you have all this money and you still don't know how to spend within your means.
Sad.
So, that's that case. It was interesting. I definitely do want to now, like, for one of my next ones, find a more paranormal UFO type thing.
Yeah. How about paranormal? I like paranormal, but UFO? No, I would like to hear one, but that was a good one. I can't believe that one's not more well known. Like you said, I'm sure people in that area or that grew up there are more aware of that, but it's kind of crazy that you don't hear some of these older stories, which I think is kind of neat though, because even like the last case, people were like, I had no idea that happened, you know?
Right.
And so I think it's cool. We'll still talk about like more current cases and stuff.
Yeah. But this just happened to be one that I thought sounded, it just happened to be an older one. We're not opposed
not well
to.
Known, though. Yeah. And that's what I love, though.
I would be
new.
Interested to see if anyone who listens did know about it or if they visited. If you visited this mansion at any point and if you had any experiences, you just thought it was a lovely place. I mean, anything.
Is it worth going?
And, you know, I guess kind of just a reminder, everyone, we want to hear your stories too. Paranormal, true crime. If there's a case that, even if you have nothing to do with it, but that you're just interested in, you want us to cover, email us at heartland.darklandpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we've already got a few messages from people that have given us some ideas of things that we weren't even aware of. And so, you know, like we said, the Heartland area, we're, of course, partial, you know, to Nebraska because that's where we're from, but we are kind of trying to get some from each state. So
I'm trying to make sure not to do another Nebraska case so soon. Like, there are a bunch of things I want to do from Nebraska because we're not covered very often.
I know.
But I am trying to show love for all of the Heartland.
Yeah. So I think, next week, I'm going to be doing something from one of the Dakotas. So, because those, you know, you just don't hear a lot of that stuff
no.
in those states. So I think it'll be fun to hear what you guys have, you know, and if you, yeah, just tell us a case that you want us to look into or whatever, and we would love to do that.
Yeah, and then again, you can follow us on Twitter at @HL_DL podcast. You can follow us on Facebook at Heartland Darkland podcast, and on Instagram at @Heartland_Darkland podcast. Mm-hmm. And we'll link again. I linked them in the show notes. We'll just keep linking them in the show notes. And I'll even link the Amazon link to book I read. I bought it used because it's an older book, so it's a little harder to come by. But yeah, and then again, if you guys could just rate and review, those do good things for us, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because it is so new and we want to kind of know where to go from here and what you would like to hear or not hear, I guess. I don't know. Be nice, though, please.
Yeah. Again, constructive criticism, but please don't be mean.
Yes. And also, we will post pictures day of.
Yes.
And I'm actually really excited to see that because sometimes it just helps to have the visual of what people, like, I'm dying to see what Marjorie looks like just so I can have this, like, visual, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's always kind of, I don't want to say fun because that stuff's not fun, but
no, but it's then neat too,
to see what we're talking about.
I've already got pictures of like Elizabeth and Velma.
Okay. Yeah.
Saved. I think it's very important that the victims are showcased. So yeah. And
awesome.
Until next time, be Heartland kind,
but Darkland wary.